Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. Dr. Fujian saying this is the Inner Voice Show. Hello to Sean in studio, and a big hello to all of you. This is a show about what matters most in our lives, our minds, our thoughts, feelings, actions, relationships, and our fulfillment in this beautiful journey of life. In this show, I'll share with you the tip of the week about ways that we can get excited and enroll others into our ideas or get enrolled in other people's ideas. And I'll share the latest research about chronic sleep disruption during adolescence, which can lead to depression. And then I'll bring you Dr. William Ferriolo. He's the instructor of philosophy at San Joaquin Delta Community College. He's the author of 5 books, including Meditation on Self-Discipline and Failure, You Die at the End, A Life Worth Living, and his latest one, The God Bless the Broken Bones. And we will be talking about application of Stoicism to contemporary challenges. So it's going to be an exciting show. But I wanted to also share with you about the Holiday Road, a drive-through amazing holiday experience, the only one in town. It's going to be at the King Gillette Ranch in Calabasas, California. It's open till January 10th. And so purchase your tickets. It's out of this world. It's get your tickets at www.holidayroadusa.com. Holidayroadusa.com. Love to hear from you. Connect with me through my website, fujian.com, fujian.com, and follow my social media and message me with your comments and topics of interest. But first, here's the tip of the week. So this week, I've been observing how when we get excited and passionate about something, a project, a task, a relationship, or a person, we tend to enroll others around us, right? I have also been a recipient of someone else's excitement and passion, which enrolled me into their ideas. There's a transference of energy, an excitement, a vision, and a connection that happens, which becomes enrolling. Many times when I talk about enrollment, it reminds people of selling a product. That's not what I'm talking about. We're in the process of enrollment all day with people around us, whether we like it or not. Let's define what enrollment is. So the Webster Dictionary defines it as to enroll oneself or to be enrolled. I define enrollment as the ability to share your ideas, thoughts, and vision in a way that another person gets it, understands it, and becomes inspired by it. Being enrolled is to the curiosity and to allow us to receive ideas and experiences that come to us and allow inspiration and joy of the gift of the novelty and expansion. So observe yourself and answer the following questions. All right, ready? Okay. Are you able to enroll others in your ideas, beliefs, or vision? Are you able to enroll your spouse in some of the ideas you have? How about your children? Can you enroll them to follow your directions or guidance? If you are the head of the company, how good are you enrolling your staff in new ideas? If you work in a company, how do you enroll the executive management in new ideas? In the current divided political arena, how good are you in enrolling your friends and family in your perspective? What are some of the belief systems that keep you from re-enrolling yourself on an insight in your own head to some of the other ideas, such as you need to be exercising or doing something while the other part of you enrolls that, no, let me just sleep and eat. So every moment, we're either getting enrolled by someone or enrolling them into our own ideas or being. If we're not allowing ourselves to be enrolled, then we're resisting novelty and change for the fear of the unknown. My experience is that when someone truly believes in an idea, believes that their idea works, it is to the benefit of others, and creates energy and vitality, and living those ideas put them in a zone. It becomes contagious. When you watch someone be elated by what they believe in, it elates you. The emotional state transfers to people around. Interestingly enough, a person might not fully agree with the idea. However, they get enrolled in the state of enthusiasm, passion, wholeness, and elation. At times, I've experienced getting enrolled in who the person is versus their ideas. For example, the way they carry themselves with confidence, or how love and peace radiates from them, or that their wholeness becomes inspiring. One of the factors of feeling alive, elated, inspired, and fulfilled is to be engaged in life. Being engaged in life is to be enrolled in new ideas and allowing yourself to expand who you are to all the possibilities that are awaiting you, allowing yourself toward an expansion of ideas, perspectives, and experiences, creating fulfillment. To observe which belief systems you keep re-enrolling yourself in from the past and see if you are still working, if they're still working for you, to see if they're open or closed, and if you're open or closed to being enrolled by others, then get my book, Life Reset, The Awareness Integration Path to Creating a Life You Want. Be enrolling of yourself and allow yourself to be enrolled toward greatness. We'll be right back.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
Well, let's talk about chronic sleep. Holidays are, and maybe we can get some sleep, but you got to listen to this research. It's amazing. Chronic sleep disruption during adolescence can lead to depression in both males and females and alter stress reactivity in females, according to the new study led by University of Ottawa, researchers, and published in the Journal of Behavioral Brain Research. It is particularly relevant in the context of the pandemic, when adolescents' mental health is already under a lot of strain. More than 264 million people around the world suffer from depression. It is a prevalent mood disorder that reduces our quality of life. Individuals diagnosed with depression experience several symptoms, including general malaise, reduced libido, sleep disruption, and suicidal tendencies in severe cases. Twice as many females as male are currently diagnosed with depression. Preliminary evidence suggests that people are experiencing greater depressive episodes and symptoms this year, likely as a result of the lifestyle changes due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Adults with depression often first experience depressive symptoms in early adolescence. However, the causes underlying adolescent depression and its sex-specific prevalence rate remain unclear. A popular theory suggests that depression originates in adolescence because of overexposing to stress. And the differences between male and female depression rates are attributed to an increased female vulnerability to chronic stress. Sleep disruption is a common stressor during adolescent development. Its repeated exposure could partially be responsible for adolescent female susceptibility to depression. Using a mouse model, researchers investigated whether repeated sleep delays differentially affected male and female adolescent mice and examined how their responses to stress changed. Results showed that adolescent male and female mice both displayed significantly greater depressive behavior after only 7 days of sleep delays, while adult male and female mice did not show depressive behavior under similar conditions. When exposed to a new stressor following 7 days of repeat sleep delay, only adolescent male and female mice showed increased activity in prelimbic cortex of the brain, not the adults. So the prelimbic cortex is associated with stress coping strategies and can be damaged from overactivation following sleep deprivation. Adolescents, females, also showed greater stress hormone release and activation of stress-sensitive brain cells than adolescent males following repeat sleep delay. These findings suggest that significant sleep delays during adolescence may increase the likelihood of depression onset in both males and females. Additionally, sleep delay may sensitize adolescent females to other stressors and increase the likelihood of mood disorders and development of that. As COVID-19 quarantine requires such a remote learning, limited in-person social interactions, and increased screen time have removed some pressure to adhere to regular sleep schedule, adolescents could be a higher risk than ever before for developing depression and mood disorders. And yes, I keep seeing that in my office constantly. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with Dr. William Finn.
Have you ever wished you could just wake up one day, reach across your nightstand, and hit the life reset button? Let's face it, the struggles and frustrations of everyday life leave millions of women and men around the globe yearning for a new way. And the new way is right here in Life Reset, the awareness integration path to create the life you want by Dr. Fujian Zane. You can get it now at Fujian.com or Amazon.com. Life Reset, the awareness integration path to create the life you want. You deserve it.
Well, welcome back, everyone. I'm Dr. Fujian Zane, and I am excited to have Dr. William Ferriolo with us. He's the instructor of philosophy at San Joaquin Delta Community College, author of 5 books, including Meditation on Self-Discipline, I need that, and Failure, Slave and Sage, You Die at the End, A Life Worth Living, and God Bless the Broken Bones. And we will be talking about the IDEA method and other applications of Stoicism and how we could use that with the contemporary challenges. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. It's an honor to be invited, and I'm very pleased to answer any questions you may have.
Well, getting ready to talk to you, actually, I started checking out what Stoicism was. And obviously, I went through your book and the meditation and your diet, you know, writing down. And first of all, I love it. This is what I'm going to take on. I'm going to definitely take on that, because the book, The Broken Bones, the God Bless the Broken Bones, is your daily journal, and that you've written it in a way that you speak to yourself frankly, frankly, and you come clean. It's almost like every day you go through this thing of coming clean with yourself. And I really, really enjoy it, because as a therapist, what we do a lot of times with journaling, we write about our emotions, we write about the daily events, we write about all of that. But there was a different essence when I read yours, which was, it could be some of those thought, but a lot more about coming clean with yourself, like getting on integrity every day about what was going on. So can you share a little bit about that? And then obviously that would also be a segue to your belief system and what you teach in the philosophy of Stoicism.
Sure, I'd be happy to. When it comes to that particular book, God Bless the Broken Bones, what I'm doing, it's a 365-day journal of my own thoughts. And my intention was to be brutally self-critical. Not unnecessarily so, not gratuitously so, but we have to be honest with ourselves about our flaws and our failings and our weaknesses if we're going to improve, if we're going to make any progress. I also write in the second person in most of the books that I've written. One exception is A Life Worth Living. That's actually a collection of essays that I've published in academic journals over the years. But the rest of them, I write it in second person. So the reader will see me saying, you failed in the following way today, or you made the following mistake today. What is wrong with you? Why are you such a weakling when it comes to resisting this or that temptation, or whatever the case may be? That's sort of been my practice ever since Meditations on Self-Discipline and Failure. Even with my most recent book, you may not have known about this one. This one just came out recently. It's called The Exile at Home, Meditations on the Passing Madness. Even this one is also written in second person and is about the recent COVID outbreak, the lockdowns, watching the rioting and the looting, what appears to me to be at least a degree of madness. So what I seek to do is to present these self-reflections that are in a stoic vein and to some extent a cynic vein, with capital C cynicism. Stoicism, the philosophical, the Greco-Roman school of stoicism, is actually descended from cynicism, which historically came first. And I'm happy to talk about the nature of those two philosophical schools and how they're applicable. I would argue they're just as applicable today to our own contemporary experiences and challenges as they were, you know, 2,000 years ago or more.
What was interesting to me, Mill, was that as I started looking at Stoicism, because I got connected getting ready for our conversation today, I started listening to some of your talks and then started listening to other people who on YouTube had talked about it and looked at what it was. And what was interesting to me is that many of those factors, I have it on my model. I talk about it as a therapist. I've heard it a lot of places. And it was interesting because it has become part of a lot of our work as we help other people. And yet I never knew where the root of it was coming from. So that's how interesting it was, like the concept of locus of control. We use that a lot in psychology and psychotherapy. And then as I was listening, I'm like, oh, that's interesting that, you know, I kept reading it through other authors coming to me. And obviously then I took it and borrowed it. And I'm, you know, giving it back in talks and lectures and how I do psychotherapy. But it was interesting to come from where it showed up first. And then it kind of led itself through our culture of you know, coaching and helping and, you know, kind of like ideologies. So what I learned, and if you could talk a little bit about these, the Stoicism values, right? The courage, the temperance, the justice, and wisdom.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I would note that if you look at the work of someone like Albert Ellis, for example, who developed REBT, Rational Emotive Behavior Therapy, he directly credits the Stoics, Epictetus in particular, with kind of laying the foundation for his work. I'm a big Albert Ellis fan. And of course, there are lots of other forms of cognitive behavioral therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy, and so on. All of it's really rooted in Stoicism. And of course, some of it also traces back to elements of Buddhism and other wisdom traditions. But Stoicism was a eudaimonistic philosophy. That's a fancy, pretentious philosopher's way of saying it's a philosophy that tries to teach us how to attain the good life. Eudaimonia means flourishing or living well, living the good life. And according to Stoicism, the four cardinal virtues, and then there are of course secondary and tertiary virtues that flow from these, but the four cardinal virtues are wisdom, courage, justice, and temperance. But the term that gets translated as temperance, I really prefer to translate it as self-discipline. So one needs the wisdom to understand the human condition, to understand what we can and what we cannot control. The dichotomy of control is very central to Stoicism. One needs courage. We tend to think of martial courage, courage on the battlefield, that kind of thing. And that is important. Obviously, we want our Navy SEALs and our Army Rangers and our Marines to be courageous. But there's also moral courage, which applies more broadly. Moral courage is called upon more frequently for most of us than is martial courage. Most of us don't have to go out and fight for a living, right? But we do need the courage to speak the truth, even when the truth is not going to be popular, to do the right thing, even when doing the right thing is going to perhaps jeopardize our employment or jeopardize friendships and so on. We need to learn to be just, to deal fairly with other people. Even if we happen to have an advantage, we should not press that advantage if it is immoral to do so, if it is not fair to the other person to do so. And of course, we also need to be just with ourselves. Some people tend to be overly self-critical, to beat themselves up, to defeat themselves through a lack of self-confidence. Finally, there is self-discipline, which I would argue is sort of wisdom and self-discipline, I would argue, are the two most important virtues. We have to be able to control ourselves in rational fashion. We have to be able to respond rationally to our various passions, our various drives, our various desires, our expectations. The more we introspect, the more we think about it, I think the more most of us will find that a lot of our expectations are not particularly rational. A lot of our desires emerge at a kind of a subconscious and unconscious level, and they emerge in a way that is that probably causes us to have a lot of unhealthy and irrational desires, and then we start pursuing those. We tend to miss want. I think I'm borrowing that phrase from Stumbling on Happiness. I forget the author's name at the moment. That's embarrassing. But we tend to miss want. We tend to want things that we believe will make us better off and make us happier if we attain them. But then when we do attain them, it turns out that they have the opposite effect, or they have no significant effect. So wisdom and self-discipline are difficult to develop. One must work assiduously, and you have to be brutally honest with yourself about what you do and don't know, what you can and cannot control, where your weaknesses are. That's what I try and encourage people to do, while I'm encouraging myself to do it. I'm in the first instance, all of my books are written to myself, which is why I'm speaking to myself in the second person. But I suspect there are other people out there who are as pathetic as I am, that they will benefit from my counsel to myself. I hope that didn't go on too long. I'm sorry if it did.
No. I was enjoying your conversation and looking at some of the differences between, for example, when you talked about the wisdom and then the self-discipline, and then what do we do with this, the knowledge of where is it that my desire, whether it's a miswant or it's a desire that shows up, can be evaluated by the wisdom and then go into the space of like the courage and the justice. You know, like you look at something that you really want, whether it's let's say, you know, impulsivity about gaining something you want, or in the world you look at greed, or you know, self-entitlement about I'm right except, you know, and others aren't and I should have this. Or even, I know that you've talked about like self-regulation as far as emotions, but that when emotions come up, to look at the expression of the emotion and not necessarily go with it, like not have the impulse of I have an expression of emotion and it just need to, like I get angry and I'm just, you know, I'm entitled and I can send it anywhere I want. So there's this part of a biological and a psychological innate way of being that shows up, right? And if I wanted to be true to myself and honor myself, then like that would show up. But there's also this concept of, okay, now monitor it and with your wisdom, create that type of a balance and kind of like evaluate what that is and then choose. And I've heard some of the lecturers that have said, choose whether you're in control and you're not in control, and, you know, to kind of like simplify it. Like, first of all, go through this concept of simplification. Okay, these are the things I can't control, dump. These are the things I can control. Okay, let's look at it. And then kind of like be on integrity with it. Can you share a little bit about that?
Sure. It is useful to simplify matters, but not to overly simplify matters. I think it was Einstein who said everything should be made as simple as possible, but not simpler, right? So when it comes to the phenomena that we cannot control, which Stoics refer to as externals, anything that is external to what the Stoics call the prohairesis, again, spouting Greek to make myself look as if I know things. The prohairesis is the faculty of deliberation and choice, or the will. And anything external to that, anything that does not conform to the dictates of my will, anything that I can't cause to happen just by choosing that it shall happen, is an external. Right? So the economic situation, the outcome of the recent election, whether a nation goes to war or not, the fact that all the people I love the most in the world are mortal and fragile, and so am I, even one's own body, right? If the way that people looked was entirely voluntarily up to them, would I look like this? Like someone who escaped from the set of, I don't know, like the Lord of the Rings or something. All that kind of stuff is not up to us. We get old, right? I'm almost 52 now. And each day I kind of look in the mirror and I think that can't be accurate. But here we are. Those things are all externals and we ought not concern ourselves about them. We ought not get upset about them. And it's also not a matter of merely shrugging and saying, nothing I can do about it. Right? We ought to be grateful for the external world as it stands, right? The external world did not need to, the universe did not need to include us in it at all, right? And in fact, if you think about the fact that our universe is anthropic, that it is habitable by creatures like you and I, the odds against that are astronomical. I mean, if you look into contemporary permutations of the fine tuning argument, I won't get too far off onto, you know, sort of philosophical cosmological stuff that your viewers won't care about. But if you look at how unlikely it is, we really ought to be very grateful that we have had the opportunity to be born at all, to draw breath at all, to have the experiences that we've had up until now. I mean, you and I are using a technology right now that did not exist a handful of years ago. When I was in graduate school, there was no such thing as the internet. I'd never heard of it. There was certainly no such thing as Zoom. So we ought to be grateful that the external world is as it is, even when it's challenging and frustrating as it can be. And when it comes to the internals, the things that do conform to just the exertion of the will, we ought to be wise and we ought to be self-disciplined about our desires, about our efforts, about our attempts to respond rationally to all the things that we cannot control. Like right now, all I can control at the moment, I can control my preparation for this interview. I can control what I say, provided that my body cooperates. If I have an aneurysm, I'm going to stop saying things, right? Or if I get hit with a sudden intense laryngitis, I'll have to pantomime the interview. So even the body is not really ours to control, but the will is ours to control. And there are better and worse ways to do it. There are more sensible and less sensible ways to interact with reality. And according to Stoicism, the rational methods of interaction, the rational expectations, beliefs, desires, tend to lead to fulfillment, tend to lead to a well-lived life. Whereas the irrational forms of interaction, and unfortunately, those are very prevalent. We begin to have desires and we begin to have aversions long before we can reason, long before we can do anything about it, right? Desires and aversions get a grip on us as soon as we exit the womb, maybe even before we exit the womb. So we have to, once we attain the age of reason, once we're able to respond rationally to our desires, impulses, passions, we will be much better off trying to be reasonable rather than remaining the cognitive or intellectual equivalent of four-year-olds for the entirety of our lives. And unfortunately, you know, some people get caught in that. Sometimes I'm a four-year-old. And now when I catch myself doing it, being, you know, I say, no. Who do I think I am to control the unfolding of reality? Who am I to say no to the way the world is or to get upset about it? You know, the rational thing to do is to respond like an adult who understands what I can and what I cannot control. Again, I hope I didn't go on too long. I tend to ramble when I get excited.
And what I get from you, which I'm enjoying, is that, you know, you take yourself serious enough, but then you really don't take yourself seriously, but you take yourself and who you are and where you are serious enough to be part of the, you know, part of the universe where you are making a difference somehow, whatever you do, whether you do it in a negative way or a positive way or whatever you think is negative or positive, that you are creating an impact. But this type of a self-reflection, which is a constant self-reflection, it's really helpful because of knowing, you know, that I'm not nothing and I'm not all thing. It's just there's constantly the question, and it's not, I don't even know. This is how I'm hearing you, and correct me if I'm not hearing you accurately, but I'm hearing you almost like, I am, as a human, a creature that is consistently evolving. And this by reflection, as I keep looking at myself, I keep looking at what the evolving looks like, because it could go anywhere at any point. And as I look at it, then I can create that type of a self-discipline, where I could say, like, you were appropriate today or not appropriate based on your own values, but based on the values that you hold. As you talk, I hear this. It's like, yes, these are the matters that and the values that I go for. But right on the other side is, I know that I'm always striving, and there's so many times that I just don't get there, and then I'm real about who I am as a human being. Did I catch that kind of accurately?
Yes, I think so. There's a reason that the word failure makes it into the title of the first of this series of books that I've written, Meditations on Self-Discipline and Failure, because failure is such a common experience. I know it is for me. I suspect it is for other people as well. I take my participation in certain projects quite seriously. It's very important to me that I really want to be a good husband to my wife. I really want to be a good stepfather to my wife's kids, my stepchildren. I really want to be a good philosophy professor, right? I take those kinds of things seriously. But as for me, intrinsically, or as for me as a specific being, I mean, come on, we're a species of talking ape, right? We're descended from, I read somewhere recently that something like 13% of the Earth's population is descended from Genghis Khan. Why? He was the most prolific rapist and murderer ever to have lived, arguably. I mean, look at where we come from. And then when I think about my own experiences, how I got here, how I ended up here, it's entirely a series of accidents and happenstance. I did not grow up saying, I want to be a philosopher when I grow up, because no one does, right? I actually became a philosopher because I lost my ROTC scholarship to college because I blew out my knee. I mean, that's how haphazard the whole thing has been. Anyone who knew me in high school simply could not take me seriously as an academic or an author or anyone who... anyone that anyone else would take seriously. I mean, I was a football player, a wrestler, a jock, a doofus throughout high school and college. And I haven't changed that much. I'm still a doofus. I still make all kinds of silly mistakes. I have a hard time taking myself seriously. Whenever people ask me questions about myself, my first thought is, well, why? why do you care? I can tell you some stuff about, you know, smart people like Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius and Seneca, but why would you care what I have to say? I'm just sitting here.
You tell us a little bit about your latest book. I didn't know about that. So tell us a little bit about that, and especially how the philosophy of Stoicism actually supports us. Can support us in the time of kind of like madness, the things that are going through where we're not used to. I mean, obviously, you know, at any point things are changing, like you said, like, you know, the technology and all of that. But right. For some reason, it's like every other thing we're striving toward and we're catching on. But this, the virus and the way that it claimed the world and what we're doing with it, it took a lot of people kind of like by surprise and still going by surprise. Although, you know, we had a lot of hello, knock, knock at the door that this might be coming. But anyway, it's about 10 months to 11 months and we still have no idea around the world of how this thing is working. So if you come looking at it from this Stoicism, what will your thoughts be?
Okay, well, I'm going to give you a kind of a two-part answer to your question. There's a sense in which my most recent book or my latest book is actually this one, Slave and Sage, Remarks on the Stoic Handbook of Epictetus. This one comes out next year. This one's in production. the other one came out earlier, even though I wrote it later, which is odd. So this is called Slave and Sage because Epictetus was literally born a slave, born someone else's property, and he was crippled at a young age because apparently his owner did not like the fact that he had a slave who seemed to be smarter than he was, and you know, kind of acted like he was smarter than he was. So here's a guy who was born a slave, he was crippled, and he still managed, after he got his manumission, his freedom, managed to become one of the most important, influential Stoic philosophers in the Greco-Roman world. And I argue that his philosophy and his approach to living a fulfilling life, a well-lived life, is every bit as useful today as it was then. The one you explicitly asked me about, The Exile at Home, the title refers to the feeling of not quite being, not quite feeling comfortable, though we are at home. We're sort of, there's a sense in which we are in exile from the conditions to which we are accustomed. Some of us look out at the culture, especially people who are a little bit older, you know, I'm almost 52, and so I've been around the nation that I see now and the culture that I see now, quite different in many, many ways from the nation and culture in which I grew up in the 70s and the 80s. So I speak a great deal about the fact that conditions that are beyond our control, if we're not rationally disciplined, they really have the power to push us around emotionally and psychologically. It's very easy to panic as a result of a pandemic, and I think a lot of people have panicked. It's very easy to succumb to frustration and anger, and you see rioting and looting and people throwing bricks through windows, and you see the violence that has been on the increase and so on. It's easy to fall into the trap of thinking, well, I'm responding angrily. I'm responding in this sort of viscerally violent fashion because of circumstances. I mean, look at what's happening, look at what's going on. Whereas I would argue that in reality, when we respond that way, it's always due to a lack of self-discipline, right? There are plenty of people in the same circumstances who are not throwing bricks through windows, who are not becoming enraged, who are not beating their spouses. Apparently, spousal abuse has massively increased since the lockdowns, which is, you know, it's something for which there is no excuse. I assume this is predominantly men hitting women, and there's no excuse for a man to abuse a woman to hit, you know. That I mean, one of the fundamental virtues is courage. What could be more opposite of courage than a man striking a woman who is presumably smaller and less able to defend herself? That's cowardice. I have no respect for people who do that. So I think if we took more time to reason about what is within our control, we would be less likely to give in to frustration and anger and despair. Some people apparently get really angry about having to wear the mask. Well, you have to wear the mask if you go to a place where it's required. If I go to a grocery store, I put on the mask and I don't get upset about it because I'm sure the grocery store doesn't particularly want to compel me to wear the mask. It's not really up to them, right? There are legal strictures on what they have to do. They're trying to run a business. They're trying to make money. I'm trying to get food for myself. It's really childish to, in my view, to throw a temper tantrum because you have to put something over your mouth and nose. Other people get really, really angry at folks who don't wear the mask. And we keep seeing these viral videos of, you know, people getting into fist fights or getting into screaming matches because someone's not wearing a mask. If someone's not wearing a mask, you might disapprove, but it's not clear how screaming at them is supposed to help. It's not clear how threatening them. I saw a video the other day, a woman wishing death on a family. There was a man and a woman with three children, and she said, "I hope you get COVID and die." Said this to children. That is not rational. That is not virtuous behavior. That is the ape in us coming out. That is the lizard brain. That is the limbic system. That is the fight or flight fear response coming out. That's not the prefrontal cortex running the show. The limbic system is powerful, but it's not smart.
That this concept of, since you brought the conversation, which you're accurate about it not being rational, to me, like, there's a lot of nudists that would say, you know, you're taking my freedom away if you require me to wear clothes. I prefer as a human being just to walk around, you know, nude. And that's my natural way of being. Who says that I have to wear clothes? And I know that even before this matter, there were a lot of places, even restaurants and places, that they would require to wear shoes. You couldn't just walk everywhere with no shoes. And some places they said you can't just walk, for example, in restaurants with bikinis. You had to wear an appropriate attire if you were going to go to restaurants, for example. So this concept, it's not new that a society and then the society creates rules and regulations for it. For example, if somebody walked around nude, they would be a legal issue. It's not just, okay, it's a preference. So I think that this thing has always been there. Now there's an additional piece where obviously because of the times, they're saying, you know, it's important for you to protect yourself and others and have this other piece of, you know, cloth on your body, the same way as you have these pieces of cloth all over your body. And you're not having a fit, because the same people who would say, I have an issue with the mask, if I raise the question, then can I have, you know, my family walk around nude around your neighborhood, they would still have a fit. No, that's not okay. Okay, well, the two arguments just don't match that much. So I do agree that some of these things, you know, it's more like an emotional, but not only emotional, but what matches my values at the time, that it might even be opposing to another value that I have. That's what I've been seeing, because I think that it's more hitting like a rebellious side of us for wanting to oppose something versus what is it that I'm opposing? It's more like, I just want to oppose something based on where I am today.
Right, what am I opposing, and is there any rational justification, not only for my opposition, but for the level of emotional response to it? I mean, it sounds an awful lot like a four-year-old when you say, oh, you need to wear a mask to come in here. No. The mask is not going to harm you. It might be vaguely uncomfortable, but some people find clothing to be vaguely uncomfortable. Yep. Some people find, you know, all sorts of forms of attire or all sorts of conditions to be vaguely uncomfortable. I'm uncomfortable on airplanes, but if I want to go visit my mom in South Carolina, I get on the airplane and I try not to complain, even inside the confines of my own unruly mind. The Stoics advocate.
Do with the seatbelt?
Right.
I remember the days that I'm old enough that I didn't have to wear a seatbelt when I used to drive. And then the laws showed up that you wear seatbelts if you wanted to drive, because right. You needed to protect yourself and whomever else was inside the car. And then, you know, slowly but surely it became a law. Then you got fined if the police got you that you weren't in suits, and slowly but surely it became a culture.
Right. And here's the rational way to approach it. Now, I was about to say the Stoics advocated a reserve clause. Form an intention to do something, fate's permitting. Form an intention to do something, given the circumstances and given the fact that there are things you cannot control. So let's say you're a person who hates the seatbelt, finds it really uncomfortable, and maybe even have a justification. Maybe you have some kind of a rash or some sort of a condition that makes it painful. Well, here are your choices. You can refrain from driving. You can get in your car and put on the seatbelt and be uncomfortable, or you can flout the law and get in your car and refuse to wear the seatbelt. But if you choose that third option, it is rational to recognize the fact that you could get stopped and you could get ticketed for violating the law. I think we probably all break laws on a fairly regular basis. I mean, you know, I sometimes participate in a poker game with some buddies of mine. I think that might be illegal. It's gambling after all. I'm sure I occasionally exceed the speed limit. Not really intentionally, just sort of, you know, you don't realize how fast you're going. If I do get pulled over for speeding, I would hope that I will not throw a fit or scream at the cop or behave like a child. I'll look at the speedometer and say, oh, yeah, I was going too fast. So one consequence is now I have to either pay the ticket or fight it in court or become some kind of low-level fugitive from justice. This is, would be kind of the most embarrassing thing. What are you on the run for? Speeding.
You choose your consequences when you choose whatever behavior it is. It's automatic. You choose this, you automatically also choose the possibility of all of those consequences.
That's correct. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people who I think kind of refuse to recognize that, or maybe have been trained not to think in terms of consequences or probable consequences. There is something of an entitlement mentality that is becoming more pervasive. A lot of people seem to operate on the assumption that they are essentially entitled to more or less anything that they want to have. More and more, there are these demands for the government to provide us, to posit us with you know, things and opportunities that none of our ancestors would ever have expected to have been given.
It's the same group that actually wants less government is feeling entitled about government giving them more. So again, they're opposing ideas right back to back. And that's a very, very interesting and complex concept that I've seen in the recent years. It's like opposing construct, right? You know, the holding side by side, coming from the same person. And it's very interesting in that. What are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, it does. We do have conflicting desires and values sometimes, especially when we don't introspect carefully, don't reason carefully about it. I actually think it's fairly widespread across the sociopolitical spectrum. I hear a lot of people clamoring for student loan forgiveness. They're mostly on the left, as far as I can tell. And these are people who voluntarily took out student loans. They chose to go to college. They didn't have to go to college. They didn't have to take out these massive loans. Often they choose majors that are not particularly lucrative, and then they can't pay back your loans. They say, hey, you got to bail me out. Well, I don't know that we have to. And of course, there are people on the right who want less government, want less intervention in their lives, but they, you know, they want the government to do something about these parks where homeless people are gathering. They often want people to intervene in the lives that other folks are living and leave them alone. I think in some sense that's kind of part of the human condition, but the fact that it's natural doesn't mean that it's wise or rational or healthy. We want our cake and we want to eat it too. And we all know.
And I think that's what I liked about your books and your system in take myself serious enough and not take myself too serious. It's that concept of looking at myself, and those are my sentences, they're not yours, but this is how it lands on me. When I reflect, and in that reflection, I can bring these, you know, kind of like the different sides of my belief system that they have an opposing view, and bring them somehow at least in front of myself versus argue this point with a lot of sense of entitlement and making other people wrong for this view, and then suddenly bring this one, which is completely opposing of this one, and bring it out. So coming into that reflective sense, I can look at both opposing, which both can be very natural and desires me, because they both obviously feed something for me, you know, it's to my benefit, both of them. And then somehow maybe integrate them, or at least acknowledge that I have both of them. And yes, they're opposing, and I use them wherever that it's to my benefit. At least I don't take myself in the sense that I know that I'm gonna use this ace card whenever that I think it's my benefit, but it's not necessarily, congruent with my other sides.
Sure. I think we all do that to some extent or other. And of course, it's impossible to dispel that cognitive dissonance, that internal conflict between desires and values, if we don't introspect and find the conflict, find the inconsistency. I meet a lot of people who claim to be devotees of such and such ideology, except when it's inconvenient. they claim to be very concerned about this or that condition, and then they behave in ways that cannot possibly be expressions of that concern. In fact, they're quite the contrary. A few examples of public figures spring to mind, but I don't want to pick on any particular individuals who are not here to defend themselves. I think it's quite natural, but I think it is also, though natural, it's emotionally unhealthy, because when you're in a condition of cognitive dissonance, when you're in a condition of having two incompatible desires, you guarantee yourself dissatisfaction, right? Yes. One of those desires is going to be frustrated. So I think sometimes instead of seeking an equilibrium between two competing desires, one has to be jettisoned. You have to relinquish one or the other. Just this morning, I mean, here's what an irrational basket case I am. This morning, I went to make myself some coffee, and I have this cat. My cat is named Sid. I named him after the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, even though he's nothing like the Buddha. He's an insane little man. He's always underfoot because he can't see very well. And he's getting old. He can't move as quickly as he used to. And so as I'm going to get myself some coffee, he had worked his way in between my feet and he almost tripped me. And so I stumbled and I almost fell. And my initial reaction, that limbic system, that ape reaction was, "Damn it, Sid!" Now, I'm getting angry at and yelling at a cat who does not speak the language. he doesn't speak English. Whose fault is that? whose fault is it that I'm angry and frustrated? The cat was in my way, but he's blind and dopey and doesn't, not like he was trying to get in my way. I'm just being a four-year-old in that moment. You know, either I want to have the cat or I don't. I do want to have the cat. Will cats and dogs and children sometimes annoy us, and friends and colleagues sometimes annoy us? Yeah, almost certainly they will.
Seems the only way to avoid. There's a self-responsibility here that creates the emotional regulation. There's an essence of that. I'm responsible for what's going on with me. Then, you know, that connects us with then looking at, is this emotion an exaggerated version? And whatever it is, it's great. But, you know, is it necessary? Is it useful? Is it even rational at that moment? Bill, can you please, in 1 minute that we have left, is there anything we have not said that you really want our listeners and audience to know about your ideas?
Here's one. This is not my idea. I won't claim credit for it, but try not to take it too personally. And by it, I mean everything, life. Try not to take it too personally. The world is going to kick the crap out of you and kill you, but not because it wants to, just because that's the way it goes. We all suffer and then we all die. But along the way, you can still have a lot of fun and enjoy yourself, and it can still be interesting. So try to suffer less than you would if you were just an irrational, screeching four-year-old. And I would argue you'll be better off, and so will people around you.
Absolutely. That's about it. Yeah. So everyone, Dr. William Ferriolo, please get his latest book that is out for you for now, God Bless the Broken Home. Is the other book out also?
All of them are out except for Slave and Sage. There are six available now, and there will be a seventh in the not too distant future. And I'm currently writing number 8. So
wonderful. Where can they find you?
If you go to my Amazon page, just go to Amazon and type in William Ferriolo. That last name is F as in Frank, Ferraiolo, bit of a weird name. And you'll see all my books available there. You can go to my, you can go to my page at San Joaquin Delta College. Not that there's any good reason to do so. And I do exist in physical reality. I'm in Lodi of Creedence Clearwater Revival fame. Oh Lord, stuck in Lodi again. That's me.
It was a pleasure to have you on the show, and you're more than welcome to join us any other time.
Well, that's great, and thank you very much for the opportunity. I genuinely appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and for all of you out there, create an amazing life for yourself and everyone around you. And until next week, bye-bye.